Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
This is Success is brought to you by TriNet, human resources that know your business. For Steve Case, this is Success.
It's how do you make sure you are doing everything you can to make the world a better place and try to kind of lift up as many people and communities as possible.
From Business Insider, I'm Rich Filoni. When Case was in college, he read a book that said a digital revolution was coming. It seemed like a ridiculous idea at the time, but it stuck with him. A little over a decade later, he helped bring about that new age as the founding CEO of America Online. He left AOL in 2005, but his career was far from over. Now, he's focused on driving what he calls the third wave of the internet. And through his venture capital firm, Revolution, he's betting on companies outside of Silicon Valley to make it happen. He's calling it the rise of the rest. It's a massive undertaking that echoes some of the vision he had back in the 80s as a fledgling tech entrepreneur.
One of the things I was really passionate about with those early days in the 80s and 90s and trying to basically make the internet part of everyday life was leveling the playing field in terms of access to information. When I was, you know, growing up, there was basically three TV networks, and you know, maybe in your town there was one, sometimes two newspapers, but there weren't a lot of diversity of voices, and you didn't really have a way to kind of get your voice out there. I didn't think that was helpful, and similarly, it was harder to compete with some of the bigger brands in the shop and commerce space. So the idea of the internet was kind of leveling the playing field and giving everybody access to information, education, commerce, reviews, whatever it might be. And that we felt was tremendously empowering. You know, the rise of rest is similar. Now it's leveling the playing field in terms of opportunity. How do you make sure everybody really has a shot? And so even though they're very different ideas and they're separated by more than three decades, to me, they are kind of similar.
And, it's kind of come full circle.
A little bit full circle.
So as an entrepreneur who has this passion for high growth startups, are you one of those people who is through and through an entrepreneur? Like you knew that from the point you were a kid?
Yeah, pretty much. I didn't, when I was a kid, I didn't know what an entrepreneur was. I don't think I'd heard of the word, but I the idea of starting little businesses and trying to create new things and see new possibilities and it's kind of always intrigued me. And so I guess I was wired to be more entrepreneurial, which is kind of a little bit unusual because my family was not particularly entrepreneurial. My father was a lawyer. Worked for the same law firm for 60 years. My mom was a teacher. And so when I was pursuing some of these entrepreneurial ventures, particularly in the early days of AOL when it didn't look like we were necessarily going to make it, they're fairly anxious about that. And so there's something about it that intrigued me.
So you came from a background where it was more like, maybe this is a bad idea. Like, why don't you just go like a traditional path in finance?
Yeah, some of that. Like that. Some of that. And I'd say I grew up in Hawaii, and Hawaii, like many parts of the country, is a wonderful place, but tends to be a little cautious, a little risk averse. That fearlessness, that sense of possibility that does exist in places like Silicon Valley, doesn't exist in many parts of the country and didn't certainly exist where I was growing up. So some of it may have been just a broader cultural kind of dynamic. But also, I think in terms of my family, it was more of the comfort zone was more kind of working for more traditional companies. And I actually did when I graduated from college in 1980. I'd already decided I wanted to get into this internet thing because I had read some things in the late 70s about, you know, kind of teletext and video text, interactive TV and online services, and a bunch of people were trying different things out and sort of early versions of interactive service. So I knew that's something I wanted to do, but when I was graduating, there really wasn't a way to do it. There was not really any consumer internet companies to go to because it didn't yet really exist. And there really wasn't much of a startup culture back then. So the idea of kind of doing my own thing just really wasn't kind of on the table. So I think probably my parents thought it was awesome when I went to work for Procter & Gamble, a company they had great respect for. A little bit less awesome than when I went to work for Pizza Hut, and much less awesome when I left the Fortune 500 world for the crazy kind of startup world. In fact, you know, the first thing I joined in 1983 when I moved to Washington, D.C., ended up failing. It was unsuccessful. So it was a kind of a wake-up call that, you know, startups are risky. They're some obviously are successful, many fail. And so it was it was part of, you know, my journey. I think it's the part of most entrepreneurs' journey.
So if you didn't grow up in a culture very much like, yeah, go out, like take these huge risks, like just follow your dream, like just go do this, where did that come from? Was that just something that was innate in you, or did you have like a turning point?
I'm not sure. I guess there was a turning point when I, in this early 1980s time frame, I just became mesmerized by the idea of the internet. I'd read a book back then, I think it was 1979, by Alvin Toffler, called The Third Wave, and he wrote I wrote a book, I named it Third Wave, and, you know, thankfully he was still alive at the time. He's since passed away, and part of the introduction to the book was really acknowledging the kind of critical role he played and you know, kind of guiding my thinking. I read his book, and he had talked about the kind of agricultural revolution. And then that was followed by the Industrial Revolution, and what he was predicting is the third wave is going to be the technology revolution, the digital revolution, which, of course, now we take for granted. But when he wrote that in, you know, the late 1970s, so four decades ago, it was, you know, kind of a crazy idea. But I read that, and I knew he was right. I knew it was going to happen. I just knew it. When I was a senior in college and was, trying to get a job, I was writing to different, you know, companies with my resume, and my cover letter basically was predicting the dawn of this digital age. And I'm sure most people thought I was like, who's this crazy kid? Yeah. Like, what is he talking about? But so most of those letters went unanswered. But definitely it was something that was intriguing to me. And I just thought it would be important, and I wanted to be part of it. And wanted to figure out ways to popularize it. And so I became kind of fixated on figuring out some way to break in, some way to, you know, kind of have a role in this first company I went to that ended up failing. That was the bad news. The good news is two of the people I met there and I ended up starting AOL, it was then called America Online, in 1985. So even though the startup was a failure, some of the relationships I forged there and some of the insights we gleaned there ended up helping in terms of the creation of America Online. When we started AOL in 1985, only 3% of people were online, and they're online an hour a week. And so it was a concept. The reality is people weren't online. Most people didn't think anybody would want to bother getting online. Like, why would somebody go to the trouble of buying a personal computer so they can, like, type a message on a keyboard to somebody when, you know, they can just pick up the phone and call somebody? Like, why? That's not going to ever work. And that skepticism was there for more than a decade. It finally, the idea of the internet, you know, kind of took off, and thankfully at that point AOL was well positioned and kind of got America Online, and at our peak about half of all the internet traffic in the United States went through AOL. But for a decade, most people didn't believe. I have that similar sense, that deja vu sense when I'm talking about the rise of the rest. I recognize a lot of people are skeptical, but we hope to prove them wrong.
Yeah,
and we believe we will prove them wrong. And maybe there is some part of my personality that sort of, when people say it can't be done, that's sort of the challenge. And so, okay, well, we'll see about that.
Head of AOL, when you were at Quantum Computer Services. So this was your first tech company that you were helping build up. You were saying how that didn't work out well. You were working with Apple, but there was a lot of bumps along the way. Just looking at that experience, what did it teach you ahead of AOL? How did it prepare you for building a company that became huge?
Well, the early days of when we started what's now known as AOL in 1985, initially the name was Quantum Computer Services. And the initial strategy, and it was true for the first several years, was essentially to partner with personal computer manufacturers to create custom, almost private label online services for each of them. So that really was our strategy. We didn't have, weren't able to raise much capital. We, I think our initial venture capital raise was about $1 million. At the time, there was a company called Prodigy, backed by IBM and Sears, and they had committed $1 billion to launch Prodigy. So our $1 million was not going to, you know, beat the Prodigy $1 billion. So rather than try to compete head-to-head, we decided to kind of have this strategy of partnerships. And so for the first several years, that was how we built the company. It was on the back of these partnerships. And so they actually worked quite well and you know, took us from this startup to actually being a real company. But one of the key partnerships was with Apple. We had licensed their brand name to create this Apple Inc. Service. And not long after launching it, they decided they didn't really like the idea of kind of having some other company use their brand. I don't think they had licensed their brand to anybody else before. I'm not sure they have since. So it was frustrating and kind of scary because we thought that was going to be a big part of our growth for the next few years. But it was clear that Apple was firm about that, and so we negotiated kind of a settlement to go our separate ways. And since we couldn't call it Apple Inc. anymore, we said, okay, we need to call it something. And, we had a little internal contest, and it ended up being America Online was the winning brand. So the challenges of that partnership with Apple kind of led us to have to kind of relaunch as America Online. And then over time, that service really got traction, and we ended up, kind of changing the company name. And, a couple of years later, taking the company, public. So, the lesson was those partnerships were critically important to get us going. We would not have been successful without them. But there was a point where we kind of had to kind of stand on our own 2 feet and move away from being so reliant on these core partnerships and instead have, I think we had 300 partners at our peak and work with a lot of media companies and computer companies and software companies and communications companies and so have a diverse kind of roster of partners but not be reliant on any one of them.
When did you realize that AOL was a huge success, that it the skeptics were wrong, that it actually had become mainstream?
It was easily a decade after we got started. It was probably 1995, maybe 1996 when we started in 1985. So it was a good decade. Even when we went public in 1992, it was the first internet company to go public. But nobody really cared. It didn't get much attention. I think, as I recall, we raised $10 million in that IPO, and the market value that day was $70 million. And it was just like some quirky little computer services company, going public. It didn't get much attention. But the other one I remember, the date I remember where it just felt like we had arrived, I guess, was in I think it was 1996. We had shifted from kind of charging by the hour to use our service to essentially a flat rate monthly fee for unlimited access. And we knew that would result in a lot more usage, but the amount of usage exceeded our expectation. So we had a huge problem with busy signals at one point. The whole system was down, I think it was for 23 hours or something. And the fact that AOL was down led the news for all the networks with one of the lead stories, the headline in almost every newspaper in the country, that AOL was down. And it was striking because it was only a few years before that nobody knew or cared what we were doing. If we'd been down for a month, nobody would have noticed. Suddenly, the fact we were down for a day was this national crisis. And that was because people had embraced the internet and really were relying on it for their email and many other services. So it went from something that was fringy and viewed by most people as sort of non-essential, maybe even irrelevant, to something that was quite fundamental.
And then shortly after that, you started ending up appearing on magazine cover after magazine cover, not only AOL becoming part of the mainstream, but you became like the face of the company. How did that feel to you when that started to happen?
It was a little weird. I did feel that from the early days, because that people were a little, I wouldn't say scared of the technology, but a little uncertain about the technology in terms of the internet and what it was going to be like. And it just seemed this computer stuff seemed a little forbidden to some people, or just a little, you know, scary to people, that we needed to, you know, make sure that AOL had a friendly face and that everything we did in designing the software and the services were try to make it more engaging, make it, you know, easier to use, more useful, more fun, more affordable. Part of the reason we even had the people signed on, the welcome message of welcome and you've got mail, was to make it feel more personal, make it feel more human. And as part of that, I concluded that I needed to kind of be the face of this service, and I needed to be kind of like, the addition to being the CEO of the company, kind of the mayor of the community. So I'd write, you know, letters to our members every month with updates on what was happening, not just with AOL, but more broadly with the evolution of the internet. And then I became a more visible spokesperson, not just for AOL, but for the medium at large, and started getting involved in the late 90s on some policy issues, including, you know, as the internet kind of came of age, how do you make sure that, you know, the right policies are put in place? So I went from being, you know, kind of relatively unknown to being, you know, quite invisible.
We'll be right back after this message.
Incredible starts when you have an expert who knows your business. It starts with TriNet, human resources that tailor a strategy for success for small and medium-sized businesses. So no matter what industry you're in, you can grow with confidence. See how TriNet's industry-focused HR can give you more at TriNet.com. Incredible starts here. TriNet.
We're back. A few years into his tenure at AOL, Steve Case was leading the digital revolution.
It's something I had been thinking about for many years, and by the time it really took off, it had been 15 plus years from the point where I first became curious about this in, you know, 1978-79 to the point where in the mid-90s things really started to, you know, take off, and the late 90s is when things, you know, really accelerated. But in some of those early years, it wasn't just the, you know, partnership with Apple. We had many other challenges where we'd have to go through layoffs, and there were times where it didn't look like the company was going to survive. So there was near-death experiences.
So when AOL became a behemoth, like by the end of the 90s, what led to the decision to merge with Time Warner in 2001?
It was a bunch of things, some kind of offensive, some defensive. We really did believe that the next wave of the internet was going to be broadband. Of course, now that's taken for granted. But in, you know, 1999, we were the leader. AOL was the leader by far, and was then the dial-up narrowband world. And the market was beginning to transition to higher speed broadband access. And we needed to be well-positioned for broadband. And so that was part of it, was to make sure we were as well-positioned in the broadband world as we were in the narrowband world. The other reason was more of a financial diversification point, that AOL's stock had soared in the 1990s and went from going public in 1992 as 70 million market cap. By the end of the decade, 7-8 years later, it was $160 billion. It was best-performing stock of the decade. I think it was up something like 11,000%. And so by merging with Time Warner, and our shareholders ended up with a majority of the combined company, you know, instead of having 100% ownership of a company, the AOL alone, I think it was $5 billion of revenue and $1 billion of profit, the combined company with AOL and Time Warner was more like, you know, $40 billion of revenue and $10 billion of profit. And so that was, you know, a more diversified mix of businesses also was something we thought was important to kind of protect us on the downside. So strategically, it made a lot of sense. I think the challenge there, the reason that it struggled and really failed as a merger, was not the strategic potential, which was certainly there, but the execution. And I've, you know, cited this quote from Thomas Edison. He said it over a century ago, that vision without execution is hallucination. You know, having a good idea is important, but being able to execute that idea is even more important. And that comes down to people and priorities. And, you know, we were unable with the combined AOL Time Warner Company to get that side of it right. The assets were there, but we didn't get the people and priorities right.
So were there lessons around execution that stuck with you that you implement even today?
Yeah, I think there are many, many lessons. And some of it was also the timing that, you know, just right after we did the merger, the market crashed and most internet companies went out of business and stock was in free fall. And so that was, you know, the timing of it, you know, kind of played into it as well. But I think a lot of it was a sort of a culture clash that people coming from the AOL side of things were viewing the internet as a great opportunity. People coming from the Time Warner side were viewing it a little bit more as a threat. You know, they were worried this internet would cannibalize some of their business. And of course, there was risk of that. But that led to different, you know, kind of approaches. And so it really came down to trust. And, you know, kind of there was not a common vision that the team embraced and was aligned around. And, you know, I'd seen the success of AOL really was having that clear vision and having a team that was kind of very aligned on and passionate about it. Instead of running it as one, you know, company, it really was run as independent divisions that each were doing their own thing. And there was, you know, more of a bias towards playing defense to protect what was there and make the near-term kind of numbers work. And you know, a little less of playing offense to kind of seize the opportunity. So I think that was a difficult chapter and certainly difficult for me personally. But having watched that, having been part of that, I realized that, you know, vision without execution is hallucination, and realized that ultimately it came down to, you know, people. And therefore, the efforts and I've tried to be focused on in the last, you know, decade or so, whether it be policy issues, working on the, you know, the Jobs Act 5 or 6 years ago, to jumpstarting our Business Startups Act, or more recently, being an advocate for the Investing in Opportunity Act. I've spent a lot of time talking to, you know, Democrats and Republicans and trying to build relationships, trying to build goodwill, trying to build trust. So there is more of a willingness to at least listen and perhaps kind of, you know, buy into things.
And in this period too, you've noted before how, like, in 2000, Vanity Fair named you the number one person in their new establishment of, like, movers and shakers. And then just a couple years after that, the media had kind of turned on you, blaming any struggles within Time Warner, like, mostly on you. What did that feel like? How did you recover from that when it seemed as if public opinion had kind of shifted against you?
Well, I didn't enjoy it. It was, I think it was hard to deal with that. And the Vanity Fair thing was particularly kind of odd because I think it was 2 years running I was like number one on their list, and then suddenly I was off the list altogether. It kind of went from being this kind of important person in the world to being kind of irrelevant. And yeah, I understood that kind of goes with the territory. It's the nature of how these things kind of work. And in terms of the merger itself, I have mixed views on it. You know, I was the architect of the merger. It was my idea. I proposed it to Jerry Levin, who was the then CEO of Time Warner. So the idea of merging AOL and Time Warner, I am completely responsible for, and I own that, you know, completely. You know, the execution of that merger, I have a, you know, somewhat different view on. I was the chairman of the company, but I did step down as CEO. And so none of the businesses, including AOL, reported to me. And we had, you know, some big fights in the boardroom about, you know, what to do. And, you know, the decision was to go in a different direction, which is why ultimately I, you know, decided to step down as chairman and leave the board. So I share some of the frustrations around how the merger was executed. I think there was enormous missed opportunities. And I accept some of that responsibility, but not all of it, because, you know, I was not really on point kind of running it day to day. I certainly accept the responsibility for the idea of the merger because it was indeed my idea.
When you left AOL and you resigned from the board at AOL Time Warner, that was back in 2005, like, you could have done like a much more traditional path, like maybe go on some board, start another company, or just have even a more standard venture capital firm. But like with Revolution, it became something where you're like traveling the country in a bus, like investing in all of these different cities that are usually overlooked. Like, were you just like trying to make things more difficult for yourself?
No, it took a little while after I stepped down as CEO to figure out exactly what I want to do. But I spent some time with some entrepreneurs, started making some investments, and enjoyed that, just sort of mentoring kind of the next generation of entrepreneurs and learning about other sectors of the economy, things that I hadn't necessarily focused on when I was running AOL, and then started ramping that up. But it, you know, definitely the whole idea of, you know, bus tours and the rise of the rest, you know, just sort of was motivated by a recognition that right now it does matter where you live in terms of whether you have an opportunity to pursue the American dream. That it's crazy to me that 75% of venture capital goes to just three states, you know, California, New York, and Massachusetts, and the other 47 states are fighting over the other 25%. These are big states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, each get less than 1% of venture capital last year, and California got 50%. So that just doesn't make any sense. There's a fairness aspect to it, but also just a, you know, kind of a opportunity aspect to it. How do you make sure that we really are leveling the playing field and we really are trying to back entrepreneurs everywhere, you know, across the country, across many sectors of the economy, so that we can continue to be the most innovative entrepreneurial nation in the world, and we can, you know, try to create jobs everywhere, not just in a few places.
It's really become a really big movement that has some of the top investors in the country involved, and you visited what, like it's 33 cities?
38 so far.
38 cities at this point throughout the country. Are you motivated by wanting to be at the forefront of a new era, like as you say, the third wave? Is this what's driving you? What is?
Yeah,
the
I think
main
there's
motivator?
Some of that. I want to be involved in that, and I think there's something I can do to help drive that. I because of my what I've done in the past, I have a voice and a platform, and I want to do something constructive with it. I want to make sure I'm doing everything I can to, you know, be helpful, and so that's a key reason, you know, why I do it. I recognize that America itself was a startup. You know, 250 years ago, it was just a startup. It was just an idea. This country led the way in the agricultural revolution and led the way in the industrial revolution, more recently led the way in the technology revolution. We've gone from this fragile startup nation to the leader of the free world. I want to do what I can to make sure we continue to lead, and we're not going to be able to do that unless we continue to innovate. The internet now, of course, we take for granted. But in those early days, most people didn't believe that it ever would be a phenomenon. So what are the other ideas out there that some entrepreneur has somewhere in this country that could not only create an interesting company but help create a whole new industry that this country can kind of lead the way on? So that's a, you know, critical, you know, part of this. And, you know, I've seen with jobs and innovation, entrepreneurship, that is one area where you can bring people together and kind of forge a consensus and find some common ground. So for all those reasons, it's something I'm super passionate about.
I joined you on the Rise of the Rest tour for Chattanooga, Tennessee and Louisville, Kentucky. When you're investing in places like this throughout the country, I would imagine that some of the challenge in terms of both pitching it to a city and just bringing in that inclusivity would be, when you think of startup jobs, you would think typically people who already have some money, who maybe are highly educated. How do you find ways that it actually does benefit an entire city and doesn't just create like a new, basically benefit the elite class of that city?
Well, there's a number of facets to it. First of all, when we talk about backing startups, we're not just talking about tech startups. Obviously, there are many tech startups, but we've backed nearly 100, you know, companies and a whole variety of different, you know, sectors, food companies, clothing companies, all kinds of things, not just tech companies. So that's the first point. The second is to recognize that the startups aren't just creating jobs directly within those companies. The data suggests that for every startup job, there's five other jobs created. It could be, you know, construction jobs for people building homes, or it could be, you know, kind of service economy jobs, restaurants, other kinds of things. So they have a kind of a flywheel effect, and they create other jobs in the community that are critically important. At the same time, and we've said this in really every city we visited, it does require intentionality. It does require making sure that you really are trying to make sure that you have a diverse mix of entrepreneurs that you're engaged with. There have been audiences as I travel around the country where I've looked out, and it's 100% white guys. Last year, over 90% of venture capital went to men, less than 10% to women. Last year, less than 1% went to African Americans. So this is a great entrepreneurial nation. We should be proud of it. But the data suggests it does matter where you live. It does matter what you look like. It does matter who you know. Whether if you have an idea, you know, you really can turn into a company and really have a real shot at the American dream. So we have to figure out ways to kind of level that playing field and be more more inclusive.
So it's kind of like rethinking the concept of entrepreneurship in America, basically.
Yeah. No, entrepreneurship, it takes many forms. And the small business sector is obviously important, accounts for a lot of jobs. Some of those small businesses could end up being big businesses. You know, every Fortune 500 company starts as a startup. So some of those small businesses, if they are, you know, kind of have access to capital or mentoring or partnerships or other ways to accelerate their growth, could be big. You mentioned being with us in Chattanooga. The, you know, winner of our pitch competition there, FreightWaves, was basically building a Bloomberg data system for the trucking industry. And I didn't know this till I got there, but yeah, as you saw, Chattanooga is actually kind of like the Silicon Valley of trucking. A lot of big trucking companies happen to be in Chattanooga. So if you're building a data system, you know, platform for the trucking industry, doesn't it make sense to be in Chattanooga where people understand trucking and the big customers, the big partners are kind of right around the corner? It seems like that's an advantage to, you know, Chattanooga. And we're seeing this in other cities as we're going around the country, that they're building on their unique skills. And so it is happening. We just need to tell those stories and get more people, you know, understanding what's happening in these communities and backing these entrepreneurs, including the investors, because the capital they need to start and scale their company is harder to get if you're in these what some call flyover country. And as a result, there's a huge brain drain where people grow up in those places, end up leaving. So how do we slow that brain drain? So
keep more people
in the region. Are able to stay where they want to stay. And even how do you trigger a boomerang if people left now feel like maybe it's time to come back, maybe it's time to come home.
When you look at your entire career and then where you are now, how do you personally define success?
I think it's about impact, and I do have a desire to have a broad impact, and so trying to kind of reach more people in more places, whether it be with the internet or more recently with the Rise Rest, it's trying to have the broadest possible impact. And I want to try to maximize the impact I have. And so I tend to pick bigger problems and try to have a kind of a bigger impact. I recognize when you do that, there are also bigger risks. You know, some of the things we try to do will not be successful. I understand that. But I think, you know, for me, it's how do you make sure you are doing everything you can to make the world a better place and try to, you know, kind of lift up as many people and communities as possible.
You've spent years mentoring entrepreneurs. It's something that you still regularly do. But is there maybe a go-to piece of advice that you would give to someone who just wants to have a career like yours?
It ultimately comes down to people and teams. That entrepreneurship is a team sport. It's not about any one person. You know, the founding CEO tends to get most of the attention, but it really is a team effort. That's certainly the case with AOL. It's the case with all the companies that we're involved in as investors. So recognizing the team dynamic and trying to make sure you have the right mix of skills and perspectives on the team is important. And the other related, you know, point, and there's an African proverb I love, which is you want to go quickly, you can go alone. You want to go far, you must go together. And going far, going together means partnerships. And so that partnership orientation, I think, is very important.
It's all about relationships.
Ultimately comes down to, you know, people, whether it be the individual people on your team or the people you need to work with to establish partnerships or the people you need to increasingly work with in this third wave that are going to impact policy, regulators, other folks. If you get the people right, I think, you know, almost anything is possible. If you don't get the people right, I'd argue nothing is possible.
Well, thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to This is Success from Business Insider. Our show is produced by Anna Mazarakis and Sarah Wyman. Dan Bobkoff is our executive producer, and I'm Rich Filoni. Before you go, we've got a glimpse at who Steve Case may have been had he pursued a different passion.
I almost went into the music business. if I hadn't gone into the, you know, the technology business. I
really?
Was quite smitten in my high school and even some college years, and you know, did some concert promotion and other sorts of things. So I could have gone into that.
Were you in a band?
I was in a band, although it was not a particularly successful band.
What kind of music was it?
We had two different bands I was in. One was called The, and the other was called The Vans. And I was the was a pretty good name, yeah. I must admit. I was the lead singer, but couldn't really sing. So I decided that was not a great career move.
Next week on the show, we've got Refinery 29 CEO Christine Barbaric. Initially, the idea of building a media startup sounded like the last thing she'd want to do. But she decided to hear a pitch from her soon-to-be co-founders over drinks.
I literally left those margaritas with Philip and Justin, and I was like, oh my God, I have to do this.
Subscribe to This Is Success in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to catch that episode and explore our archive. Please leave us a rating and write a review. It helps others find the show. This Is Success is a production of Insider Audio.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.